I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of March. This hour of the program, what direction will Benjamin Netanyahu take during his fourth term? We'll be talking about the race that, you know, people were saying on Tuesday might be too close to call. But that certainly wasn't the case. A very high turnout, 72% of eligible voters taking part. And in recent weeks, polls had shown the support for Netanyahu was going down. And days before the election, he was even warning that his supporters, that Likud, might lose. But there was a media blitz. There were some controversial actions on the part of Benjamin Netanyahu the Monday before the election and the Tuesday morning of the election. What about the relationship with President Obama? No love lost between the two of them. What about Iran? What about the rest of the world? We'll be welcoming your phone calls this hour of the program, and I'm sure that many of you have a response to this very large election. Our guest is Michael Koplow. He is program director of the Israel Institute. He has served as a researcher at the Council on Foreign Relations and trained foreign service officers for the State Department. He writes for Foreign Affairs, the National Interest, Foreign Policy, and the Atlantic, and other publications. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Michael, thanks very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
The election turned out to be what has been described as a clear mandate for Netanyahu, and yet everybody was a little bit surprised by that. Polls were showing that he was probably going to lose. What happened? How did he pull out a fairly substantial victory?
So the polls before the election didn't necessarily show that Netanyahu was going to lose. They showed that Netanyahu was not going to finish in first, which in the Israeli system does not always matter. In fact, in 2009, Prime Minister Netanyahu became the prime minister despite the fact that the Likud party came in second place. But the reason that people had been predicting a loss for him going into the election was that his Likud party was down in the polls to Zionist camp, and Zionist camp's alliance had been polling anywhere from 2 to 5 seats higher than Likud was. Mm-hmm. And so there was an expectation among lots of people that Zionist camp was going to be the party that received the opportunity to form the first government.
Go ahead.
Please.
No, I was just going to ask if you were surprised by the results.
I was certainly surprised by the gap between Likud and Zionist camp. I was not surprised that Likud finished in first. I expected Likud to finish in first, but I certainly did not foresee them getting 30 seats, which is what they ended up with, and I did not see them beating Zionist camp by 6 seats.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you have to remember that in the context of Israeli politics, what is most important is not necessarily which party has the most votes, but which bloc has the most seats to form a coalition government. And even had Likud and Zionist camp finished tied, or even had Zionist camp finished ahead of Likud, Netanyahu always had an easier path to building a coalition than Zionist camp and Buji Herzog did.
Let's concentrate on two of the controversial things he did that have received so much press. On Monday, he declared there would be no independent Palestinian state. On Tuesday, in an action that many have condemned, as the voting centers opened, he urged people to head out in order to counter supposed droves of Israeli Arabs voting in the election. And those have been called scare tactics that seem to have worked. Were they scare tactics?
They were certainly tactics that worked. The question is whether they were scare tactics or straight electioneering tactics. On the first issue, the one of two states, I don't think that it came as a surprise to many observers that Prime Minister Netanyahu would have denounced creating a Palestinian state, as much as he has paid lip service to it over the past two consecutive terms in office. There's much evidence that it's something that he hasn't really wanted to see happen. Ruling out the possibility of a Palestinian state during his term as prime minister was designed to draw votes from the far right, and this is one of the reasons that Likud performed so much better than people expected. If you look at the way the electoral blocks finished up, the right-wing bloc actually only has one more seat than they had after the 2013 elections. The difference this time is that Likud has a much higher proportion of the right-wing bloc itself. And the way Netanyahu accomplished that was by tacking to the right and by convincing people who in the past had voted for farther right, more nationalist parties that they had to vote for Likud. On the question of his statement warning that droves of Arabs were being bused to the polls, there's no question in my mind that that was fear-mongering, and certainly inappropriate fear-mongering at that. Whether that particular tactic worked, I guess we'll never know, but it certainly wasn't a very pretty way to win the election.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that ultimately, as some have suggested, he will back off on the Palestinian state question, that he'll agree that it is necessary, as he has in the past?
Well, in fact, he already has backed off it. He gave an interview this morning to MSNBC where he said that his statement on Monday against the Palestinian state was not an absolute statement. He hedged it by saying that he doesn't think a Palestinian state can be created now because of the security danger to Israel and that there is no appropriate Palestinian partner to negotiate with. But he said that his stance has not changed and that he's always been in favor of two states as long as Israel is able to negotiate with a partner that genuinely wants peace and that will genuinely respect Israel's security. And so certainly he's walked it back already. The question remaining is whether the damage is already done and whether his walking back his statement disavowing a Palestinian state will be enough. Essentially, whether you take him at his word on Monday or whether you take him at his word from this morning.
Mm-hmm. I think it was in the New York Times today or yesterday, somebody saying that Iran really decided who would be the prime minister in Israel. Iran was and is the ultimate demon for masses in Israel. Israelis fear the future, and they trust only a strong nationalist leader. Did Iran really decide?
I don't know if Iran decided. It's important to note that there really is unanimity across the Israeli political spectrum that Iran presents an existential threat to Israel. And it's notable that Buzi Herzog, who was running to be prime minister from Zionist camp, has an almost identical position on Iran as Prime Minister Netanyahu does. He is no less hawkish on Iran. The person who he had tapped to become defense minister had he won, Amos Yadlin, who incidentally is one of the pilots who bombed the Osirak reactor in Iraq back in 1981, his position on Iran is that Iran cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon and that if Iran becomes a nuclear threshold state, Israel should do everything in its power, including military raids, to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities.
Mm-hmm.
So irrespective of who emerges as prime minister, and at this point it's almost guaranteed to be Netanyahu, I don't think the Israeli position on Iran would change. But it is certainly accurate to say that Israeli voters seem to trust Netanyahu more in security. He projects a stronger image. He's certainly more hawkish in his rhetoric across the board. And security is something that is always first and foremost on Israeli voters' minds.
And what else do Israelis fear about the future right now?
So if you had asked if you'd asked Israelis before the election what they were voting on, the polls revealed that most Israelis were concerned about socioeconomic issues. Now, that doesn't seem to have been borne out in the results, but certainly many Israelis are indeed worried about housing prices and banking reform and the cost of basic staples. In addition, Israelis are legitimately worried about what's going on in Gaza with Hamas and the possibilities of what will happen in the West Bank. It's only this summer that rockets were being shot from Gaza into Israel, and Israelis have intimate experience with air raid sirens and having to go into bomb shelters, and so that's something that's on their minds as well. And finally, I think there are many Israelis, and these are people who voted not for Netanyahu but for the left, who are worried about Israel's international isolation. Who think that without a legitimate two-state solution and a legitimate peace process, that Israel is going to become increasingly isolated. And the folks who are most despondent today and yesterday over the results in Israel are the ones who fear that another Netanyahu government is going to deepen the occupation in the West Bank and make Israel more isolated in the world.
Mm-hmm. There was an interesting letter in the Times today, and I'd like for you to respond to this because it does talk about fears, and I wonder what Netanyahu's government does about this, or what Israel does about this, and what the Palestinians do about this. The person who was writing from Israel said on Tuesday there were a number of terror attacks against innocent civilians, rocks thrown at cars and buses in the Jerusalem area by Palestinians, and in a settlement, a car driven by a Palestinian tried to run over Israeli soldiers. This author said, this is why Netanyahu was reelected. How Americans living in the U.S. would deal with daily terrorist attacks against innocent men, women, and children. There will never be a Palestinian state adjacent to Israel as long as terrorism continues.
So, again, Netanyahu is seen as a trustworthy figure on security by many Israelis, and really all Israelis have, as I said, a very strong connection to being terrorized. Whether it's rockets from Gaza, or whether it's the suicide bombing campaign that came along in full force with the Second Intifada, and so yes, it's something that's certainly always on Israelis' minds.
Mm-hmm.
The question of whether that was going to automatically lead to Netanyahu being reelected, I'm not quite so certain. Israelis do have that concern, but they have other concerns as well. And it's also important to remember that as we talk about a landslide victory for Netanyahu and a huge victory for him, Israel is a system that is proportional representation. And so despite the fact that we're talking about what was a landslide victory for Netanyahu and him becoming prime minister for a third term, he only received 23% of the vote. And so I think it's difficult to divine from that any large-scale lesson that applies to Israelis as a whole or Israeli society writ large.
And when you say they see him as trustworthy on security, what does that mean? What's his trustworthiness? How does it play out?
His trustworthiness stems from the fact that, as I indicated, Israelis of all stripes are legitimately worried about Iran, and Netanyahu has been the most hawkish voice saying that Israel cannot accept a nuclear Iran. And so even though everybody, for the most part, across all the parties holds that position, Netanyahu has been warning about it the loudest and the longest, and I think that certainly speaks to many Israelis. And in general, the Likud party is seen as being a hawkish party. It is seen as being tougher on security. And in general, the conventional wisdom is that Israelis who are worried about security are going to vote for the right wing, and Israelis who are worried about the economy are going to vote for the left wing. And the fact of the matter is that, particularly since the Second Intifada broke out in 2000, security has been an issue on Israelis' minds, and the right has won election after election.
Right.
People discount how scarring the Second Intifada was, but it's something that really affected the Israeli electorate in a far-reaching way.
We talked about what he said about a two-state solution on Monday, and you mentioned his interview today with NBC News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Andrew Mitchell. And today he said, I don't want a one-state solution. I want a sustainable, peaceful two-state solution. I mean, in the course of 4 days, what a flip-flop, isn't it?
It certainly is a flip-flop, but you know, Netanyahu on Monday, the way he stated it when he came out against the Palestinian state, he did give himself enough wiggle room to make the flip-flop believable if you choose to believe him. When he said on Monday that there would never be a Palestinian state under his watch, he preceded it by saying that it would be foolish today to give up land to Islamist terror groups who would create a Palestinian state. And so he did give himself enough wiggle room to be able to back out of it if he chose to do so. And frankly, it shouldn't come as a surprise that he's backing away to an American audience now. Netanyahu is very worried about the U.S. continuing to exercise its veto in the United Nations Security Council. And the White House, ever since Netanyahu's re-election, has been sending very strong signals that it is reconsidering using its veto to shield Israel from resolutions in the Security Council. And that's Netanyahu's number one diplomatic concern at the moment. So it's not terribly surprising that he'd walk it back.
Mm-hmm. And what about the relationship between Netanyahu and Obama? You can't imagine it getting much better. It must be pretty darned icy.
Forget about getting much better. I'd say, you know, you can't imagine it getting much worse. It's pretty much as bad as any relationship has ever been between an American president and an Israeli prime minister. And I see no prospect for it improving over the next 22 months. Neither man trusts the other. They have naturally different temperaments. They have different worldviews. They clash on all sorts of policy issues. And they each feel that the other has personally slighted them. And so, no, I certainly don't expect it to improve. And I think that each of them is just waiting to weather out the next 22 months until there's a new president.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Michael. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A clear mandate for Benjamin Netanyahu, Tuesday's elections in Israel. What's he going to do now? What are we going to do now? What's Iran going to do now? What are the Palestinians going to do now? Those are the questions of the hour, and we welcome your thoughts as well. Here's how you reach the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Michael Koplow is program director of the Israel Institute. He has served as a researcher at the Council on Foreign Relations. He writes for Foreign Affairs, The National Interest, Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, and other publications. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, welcoming phone calls as we look at the Netanyahu victory. 800-486-8655 is our number, and our first caller is Antonio in Green Bay. Hi, Antonio.
Hi.
Hi.
I just turned on the radio maybe 10 minutes ago, and I'm very impressed with the gentleman who's speaking. I just want to compliment him for being neutral and so reflective about especially the personality analysis he just put on together. Yes, he's dead on Netanyahu and Obama. And Netanyahu is the same as basically George Bush and Putin. And they all want to look tough and talk tough and disregard actual reality, what's behind the reality. Poor people, instead of negotiating, they just shoot their mouth and look tough. I mean, anyway, I just want to compliment the gentleman, as I said, and I thank you very much for speaking so fluently and eloquently. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, that was nice, Michael.
always glad to have a fan.
Absolutely. A fan you didn't know about in Green Bay, right. Wisconsin. Thanks, Antonio. Let's go to Paul in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment in a slightly larger strategic sense that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Iran and the bomb, and I think that's an important part of the discussion. But I also think that from a strategic sense, Netanyahu is afraid of the United States and Iran having a diplomatic breakthrough and warming of relations. And I think that his efforts are a serious attempt to block any improvement in relations between our two countries.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. You know, not only Israel, but many of the U.S.'s traditional Sunni allies in the Middle East are very scared of detente between the U.S. and Iran for a number of reasons. First of all, as the U.S.'s traditional allies, they don't want to be left out in the cold. And second, Iran has created a lot of headaches for them, given that Iran in general has, since the revolution in 79, been trying to push back against Sunni hegemony in the region, and obviously it objects to many things about Israel, and so it's not just Israel, but the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and a host of others who, in many ways, do not want to see a better relationship between the U.S. and Iran. They think that the administration's approach to trying to warm relations with Iran is a mistake. They view Iran as being a country that has ambitions to take over the region, and certainly that's a big component of it. You know, Israel is in a somewhat special situation in that they are the brunt of more rhetorical threats from Iran than any of the other Sunni countries in the region, and they are certainly worried about an Iranian nuclear weapon either being trained upon them or giving the Iranians cover to make all sorts of trouble in other ways. But yes, the prospect of a larger deal between the U.S. and Iran certainly hangs over the discussion surrounding an Iranian nuclear weapon.
What about Israel's thoughts and actions in taking on ISIS?
So Israel isn't quite sure what to do about ISIS. On the one hand, ISIS does not seem like it is a direct threat to Israel itself. On the other hand, one of the countries that is most threatened by ISIS is Jordan, and Jordan is one of the two Arab countries that has signed a peace treaty with Israel, and they're actually, as opposed to the peace between Israel and Egypt, which is a very cold peace, the peace between Israel and Jordan is actually, I don't know if I would use the word warm, but the two are certainly allies behind the scenes. They cooperate in all sorts of ways. And, you know, Israel's big nightmare on the West Bank is for King Abdullah to fall in Jordan and for ISIS to take over Jordan, because then Israel is presented with a huge security problem. And so they're certainly worried about ISIS in that sense. In Syria, in some ways, the calculation goes the other way, given that Bashar al-Assad is an Iranian client, and Israel does not want to see Hezbollah any closer to its border than it already is in southern Lebanon. And so, you know, Israel is in a tough bind with ISIS, and there's a lot of debate within the security establishment as to which direction to go. I think at this point, you know, Israel is certainly going to be happy to see ISIS rolled back, but the Israelis don't want to be involved with ISIS any more than they have to be. And so to the extent that ISIS does not threaten the Jordanians, the Israelis will be happy. And to the extent that ISIS and Assad keep on fighting to a stalemate, I think many Israelis see that serving their interests as well, since neither side is good for them and neither side will win.
Paul's gone. Thanks, Paul, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu, Tuesday's elections in Israel, and all that that means. Tom writes to us on Facebook, if Netanyahu is such a strong leader, will he stop taking America's money? Time to stand on your own, Israel.
Well, there are a couple of things to point out about that. Israel used to be the beneficiary of large amounts of economic assistance and military assistance from the United States. Starting in the last decade, to be precise, it might have been 6 or 7 years ago, the economic assistance to Israel was ended in its entirety, and all of the assistance that goes to Israel now is military. Now, on the one hand, it's obviously helpful to the Israelis, but it's helpful to the U.S. as well, because the U.S. has always, as a policy, wanted to maintain Israel's qualitative edge militarily in the region. But secondly, it's important to note that of the $3 billion that goes to Israel every year in military assistance, 85% of it, or 88% of it, by law, has to be spent in the United States. And so what it actually ends up being, aside from assistance to Israel, is a huge subsidy to the U.S. defense industry. And so even if Netanyahu were to turn around tomorrow and say, you know what, thanks, we don't need the annual military assistance anymore, there would be a huge amount of pushback from the defense industry in the United States, which benefits from this greatly. And then the other aspect of it is that much of the money that goes to Israel for military assistance ends up being used on weapon systems that are jointly developed by the U.S. and Israel, or that are tested by Israeli companies for the U.S. benefit. And Iron Dome, which was in the news over the summer, since that is the weapon system that the Israelis have used to shoot down rockets coming from Gaza, is one such system that was developed jointly by the U.S. and Israel. The U.S. military sees benefit to having this system tested in battlefield conditions, and Israel, for better or for worse, is an ideal place to have these types of systems tested.
Let's go to Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. My question is, we hear a lot of rhetoric, anti-Iran rhetoric, and I'm just curious, how much of that is masking just concern of keeping Iranian oil off the market from further depressing oil prices? A lot of people think that the Iraq war was mostly about oil, and just wondering if this same situation here in Iran, that most of this is just about keeping Iranian oil off the market.
Well, I've never seen any convincing evidence that the Iraq War was about oil, irrespective of what people like to think. The U.S., after invading Iraq, did not take Iraqi oil, is not taking Iraqi oil. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the analogy is the correct one. In terms of Iranian oil, I'm sure that there are some people who are concerned about it. But frankly, the energy prices are so low now that I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's much of a concern. That's much of a concern for anyone. And certainly on the Israeli side, it's not an issue. They're not worried about Iranian oil. Or the price of oil in the market. They are worried about Iran as a military threat.
I didn't understand this. In reading about all of this today, I'm not sure what the origins of this bill were. I do know that it was of great concern to Israel's Arab citizens. What was this nationality bill emphasizing Israel's Jewishness over its democratic nature, Michael?
So it wasn't the bill that was introduced was going to officially declare Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people, and so it wasn't defining Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people against and not a democratic state, but it was seeking to first and foremost embed in Israeli law that Israel is a Jewish state, the homeland of the Jewish people. That Hebrew would be the only official language of the state, while Arabic would have a special status. Basically, it would emphasize Israel's Jewish character, and obviously, many Arab citizens of Israel had a problem with that, since they are not Jewish. And enshrining a bill into law that would explicitly confirm that Israel is a Jewish state first and foremost was problematic to both to obviously non-Jewish citizens of Israel, but was problematic to many Jewish citizens of Israel on the left as well. That bill was not passed. It still exists only in the form of a bill. But I anticipate that it's gonna keep on coming up in this government and subsequent governments, because on the right, it's a very popular position, and it ties into one of the things that Netanyahu has made an explicit aspect of any deal with the Palestinians, which is this idea that the Palestinian Authority has to recognize Israel as the Jewish state. It's kind of two sides of the same coin. On the one side, it's affirming domestically that Israel is a Jewish state first and foremost, and it's also asking the Palestinians to recognize that Israel is a Jewish state. So the two are tied, and it's very it's a very popular issue among the nationalist camp in Israel, and it's going to keep on coming up.
Mm-hmm. And the other question I had was about this $300 million in taxes that Israel collects on the Palestinians' behalf, and it's withheld that money since January as punishment, I read, for their joining the International Criminal Court.
Correct. So under the Oslo agreements, the Israeli government collects tax revenues on the Palestinian Authority's behalf and transfers them to the Palestinian Authority. Israel has taken the position that by going to the International Criminal Court and seeking to join, and the Palestinians are going to become members of the ICC on April 1st, that this is a violation of the Oslo Accords, since it's a unilateral move, and the Oslo Accords provided for the creation of a Palestinian state only through direct negotiations with Israel. And so Israel has been withholding this tax revenue, the Palestinian Authority has been warning that if tax revenue is not transferred over, it is going to have to seize security cooperation with Israel in the West Bank, which would create an enormous headache for Israel. I expect that now that the election is over, the revenue is going to be transferred over relatively easily and quickly. It was a very potent campaign issue for Netanyahu. Again, the nationalist parties in Israel and nationalist voters tend to view withholding tax revenues for this sort of thing, for going to the ICC and for other unilateral Palestinian moves. They tend to view that as a good thing, and it's very popular. And it was certainly an aspect of the right wing's campaign in this election. Now that the election is over, and Netanyahu has what appears to be a pretty set coalition. Obviously, it's not official yet, but the parameters of the coalition are well known to everybody. I'd be surprised if the tax revenue was not transferred over pretty soon, because nobody, and this includes Netanyahu, wants to see the Palestinian Authority cease security cooperation with Israel. The Palestinian Authority is very effective at keeping the West Bank calm and quiet, and if the PA decides that they are no longer going to cooperate with Israeli security and work together to prevent any unrest, Israel is going to be forced to send the IDF into the West Bank in very high numbers, and that's the type of thing that really doesn't end well for anybody. Mm. So the tax revenues have been an issue, but I don't think they will be for very much longer.
And the Palestinians want to be with the International Criminal Court because they believe that the court will do what for them?
I think it's two things. On the one hand, the Palestinians are trying to join as many international organizations as they can, because the more bodies there are that recognize Palestine as an independent state, the more it becomes a fait accompli and just facts on the ground. And at some point, the Palestinians feel that they won't have to negotiate with Israel anymore. At some point, if enough people confirm that there's a Palestinian state, then there is a Palestinian state. That's part of it. The second part is that the Palestinians know by joining the ICC, they hold something over the Israelis' heads that they haven't been able to do before, which is the prospect of prosecution of all sorts of high-ranking Israeli politicians, military officers, and others. And they're using this. They've been threatening to join the ICC for years. They finally have done it, and I'm sure that if they do not like the way negotiations are going, or they don't think that negotiations will happen, that they will not hesitate to try to have members of the Israeli government taken to court in the ICC.
Thanks very much for your call, Jackie. And we go next to Jerry in Menasha. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Yes, I'm getting a little tired of this hypocrisy relative to poor Israel. I'm far more worried about the poor Palestinians. However, why doesn't anybody ever talk about the 100 to 200 nuclear weapons Israel has? Netanyahu couldn't wait to hot foot it on over here. And who did he address? The hawks in our Congress. I'm tired of the endless wars we've been being involved in. Netanyahu would just love the United States to get involved into a war with Iran. We need peace over there. We have to continue to negotiate, irrespective of what's going on, because we cannot afford any more war in the Mid East. This has got to come to a stop. We've got to stop this wartime mentality that's developed in our Congress just because the military-industrial complex is making a high dollar.
Michael.
So I would agree with the caller's sentiments that peace in the Middle East is a good thing, and I am an unabashed supporter of negotiations, the peace process, a two-state solution, and a Palestinian state. I'm not sure what the caller is referring to in terms of fighting countless wars in the Middle East on Israel's behalf, but certainly I would like to see a quiet region. On the question of Israel's nuclear weapons, Israel is widely presumed to have a robust nuclear program. It is something that Israel has never publicly admitted, but it's probably the worst kept secret in all of foreign policy. I think that one of the reasons that people tend not to harp upon the Israeli nuclear program the same way they do on the Iranian nuclear program is that Israel is presumed to have had nuclear weapons now for over four decades, and not once have they used them or threatened to use them on anyone. Whereas the Iranian regime, while it presumably does not yet have a nuclear weapon, in many cases has threatened to use those nuclear weapons on Israel. And so I think that the gap in focus on the Israeli nuclear program versus the Iranian nuclear program in a lot of ways comes down to rhetoric, and comes down to the fact that whether you agree with Israel having nuclear weapons or not, the fact is that they've had them for four decades but have not used them, threatened to use them, and it's very difficult to imagine a situation in which Israel would use nuclear weapons first. And I think that accounts for a lot of the gap in focus.
Thanks very much, Jerry, for your call. When you used that phrase, wanting to see a quiet region, I was thinking in my mind, Michael, that's almost impossible to imagine, isn't it? Or can you?
No, and I unfortunately can't. The region is certainly in turmoil. It has been for a long time, but things seem to be particularly bad at the moment. And you know, some of it obviously, you know, there is the ongoing conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, and there is the constant war of words and actually lots of violence that goes on behind the scenes between Israel and Iran. And when you add on top of that the rise of ISIS, the Syrian civil war, the various unrest that has been taking place in Arab countries since 2011, certainly the region doesn't seem like it's going to be on its way to getting quieter anytime soon.
No.
That's not to say that there haven't been developments in recent decades that are good. There hasn't been an Israeli-Arab war since 1973. So, you know, on at least on one front, things have improved. But yes, in general, the Middle East is certainly a mess, and there doesn't seem to be an easy way out of the morass anytime soon.
Michael Koplow is our guest this hour. He's program director of the Israel Institute. He has trained foreign service officers for the State Department, served as a researcher on the Council on Foreign Relations, and does a great deal of writing and analysis for Foreign Affairs, the National Interest, Foreign Policy, and the Atlantic. He did some reflection on Netanyahu's speech before Congress. We'll ask him about that. And welcome more of your phone calls. Major election in Israel on Tuesday, securing Netanyahu's power for years to come, and we're talking about how he got that and whether he'll walk back any of his statements about a two-state a solution to this problem, and what he had to say about countering large numbers of Israeli Arabs who would be voting in the election, urging his supporters to get out and counter those droves of Israeli Arabs. The relationship with Netanyahu and Obama, which our guest says is not likely to get, is only likely to get worse, not better, over the next 22 months. And so there's a lot on the table. Feel free to join our conversation. We have lines open for you right now. And the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number now for Israel and the results of the election this Tuesday, 800-486-8655. And let's go to Walter in Verona next. Hi, Walter.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's a very enlightening program, and I appreciate your time and Michael's time. My question is one I think a lot of people think about, and we think about it, you know, in a cursory manner, and give it little additional thought. But, Michael, my question for you is, what are truly the implications and taking a deep dive of the Palestinians recognizing Israel? You know, I'm driving along and I'm thinking, okay, sure, why don't they do it? But what are the implications? Does it mean that it will disenfranchise the Arabs living in Israel? Will it cause Israel to be recognized as purely a Jewish state, irrespective of other religions, what happens to the other religions in the country? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
So the big implication from the Israeli perspective, and I should clarify, it's not the Palestinians recognizing Israel as a state, because the Palestinian Authority has recognized Israel, obviously, as a state. It's recognizing Israel as an explicitly Jewish state. From the Israeli perspective, the problem with the reason that they want the Palestinian Authority to recognize Israel as a Jewish state is because of the issue of the right of return. You know, of the issues that the Israelis and Palestinians negotiate over, the one that's really a huge red line for the Israelis is the right of return, which refers to the return of refugees, Palestinian refugees who either themselves lived in what is now Israel before 1948, and their descendants. The issue is their return to Israel, because Israel's fear is that if Palestinian refugees are given the right of return, there will be more Palestinians in Israel than there are Israeli Jews, and then Israel will cease to be a Jewish state. And so when the Israelis demand that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state as part of any negotiated deal for a two-state solution, that's really code for wanting the Palestinians to accept that the right of return may happen in a limited token amount, and certainly any deal would include a token amount of refugees returning to Israel. But what the Israelis are really asking is for the Palestinians to once and for all drop the demand, and for Palestinian refugees to either stay where they are now in various countries, or to go to a new Palestinian state and not to return to Israel. And that's why it's such a big issue. Israel's identity as a Jewish state is very important, both to many Israelis and to many Jews outside of Israel. And so the demand to recognize Israel as a Jewish state is about preserving Israel as majority Jewish, not about trampling on the rights of non-Jews who are there. And obviously there is discrimination. There is discrimination in Israel against non-Jews in many ways. But non-Jews in Israel are enshrined with full right to citizenship, and so it isn't about removing citizenship rights from non-Jews in Israel. It's about ensuring that Israel maintains a Jewish majority.
Thank you so much for your interesting call. We go to Cheryl in Middleton. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sort of related. So the comment about the Oslo Agreement and that. The Palestinians could only negotiate with Israel on the terms of what's left on the table, with Netanyahu saying that a two-state solution is not going to happen under his watch. What is really left then to negotiate?
So from the Israeli perspective, what they would say is that Israel is willing to negotiate with the Palestinians so long as the Palestinian Authority is willing to sit down at the table without any sorts of preconditions. From the Palestinian side, they would certainly agree with what you're implying, which is that there is no negotiation possible, that if the Israeli government says straight out that no Palestinian state is possible under the current government, then there's no point in negotiating at all. And in fact, the Palestinians over the last year have been moving very rapidly toward that conclusion. And many of the Palestinian efforts over the last few months have been geared toward this idea of, rather than negotiating a state for themselves with the Israelis, of basically forcing the issue with the international community, whether it be joining organizations like the ICC or requesting that the UN recognize an independent Palestinian state, or whether it be through what people call lawfare, which is using international law to explicitly force the issue, and that's one of the strategies behind the ICC. I think that many Palestinians, if not most, would probably agree with the statement that that Israel is not interested in negotiating with them, and so why should they bother? The Israelis, and certainly Prime Minister Netanyahu this morning, took this tack, would say that that's incorrect, that Israel is prepared to negotiate, and that it's the Palestinians who are fundamentally not serious about negotiating and have shown that they've turned their back on it.
I want to spend just a moment, thank you very much for your call, talking about why he made the decision to come to Washington to speak to the U.S. Congress, obviously upsetting the President of the United States. It was kind of an unusual thing to do, wasn't it? Why would he do that?
It definitely didn't seem like an ordinary move.
Right.
There are competing explanations. My own view is that he largely did it for campaign purposes. When you're running a campaign and your number one issue is security, which Netanyahu's was, it obviously looks good for you and makes you look like a strong leader if you can go to the United States and give a speech before Congress and and have senators and congressmen from both parties cheering you and giving you a standing ovation. It certainly, from an optics perspective, it reinforces the image of you as a strong, steady leader. In addition, the one foreign policy issue which the left wing had seized upon was worsening relations with the U.S. under Netanyahu. But that really has been in many ways confined to the White House, not to Congress. And so this was also a way for Netanyahu to push back on that a little bit and say, well, you know, actually relations between Israel and the U.S. are robust under me. You know, look at the reception that I've been given in Congress. That's my take on it. But, you know, there are certainly people who argue, perhaps less cynically than I do, that Netanyahu went genuinely because he's concerned about Iran. And I don't mean to imply that that Netanyahu was not genuinely concerned about Iran. I'm unable to see how his speech to Congress helped his own position on Iran rather than harming it.
Hmm.
But there are certainly plenty of people who will make the argument that Netanyahu went to Congress to do everything he could to prevent a bad deal being signed by the administration and to encourage Congress to do everything they can to have oversight of any deal that's signed and to pass a bill that would increase sanctions on Iran should they break any aspects of the deal going forward.
Michael, you choose your words well. You do. And what about the popularity of President Obama in Israel? Is he not very well thought of?
No, he is extremely unpopular.
Is he?
Extremely unpopular.
Hmm.
It's in my lifetime, certainly, there likely has not been an American president who has been more unpopular.
Goodness.
With Israelis. And again, it's not entirely a left-right divide. In a lot of ways, it's across the board. And it stems from a feeling that Israelis have that President Obama came into office and simply wasn't interested in them. They watched him go to Istanbul and address the Turkish Grand National Assembly, and they watched him go to Cairo and give a big speech addressed to the Muslim world, and they watched him go to Indonesia. And all that time, he did not come to Israel. And Israelis, in a lot of ways, felt slighted, and they feel that President Obama has a grander plan and that Israel isn't necessarily part of it. And so... There are certainly people who oppose him politically, but a lot of it is really just people don't feel that he gets them.
Hmm. Thank you so much. What an informative hour. You're a terrific guest, and we thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Michael Koplow, our guest this hour, program director of the Israel Institute. Michael writes for Foreign Affairs, the National Interest, Foreign Policy for the Atlantic. He served as researcher at the Council on Foreign Relations and has done training of foreign service officers for the State Department. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up in just one moment, and then we'll return and talk about presidents in moments of crisis with the author of a very fine history of 17 moments of crisis going all the way back to Harry Truman. So we're looking at 65 years of times when presidents, more often than not, were given a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning, because that's where a lot of the world is, on a different time zone, and they have to deal with an issue that will have enormous consequences for the world. So we'll look at how they dealt with crises after we hear the news, and that's coming up in just one moment. Stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.